the tools and things that I, the approaches that I take in order to do this kind of work is multidisciplinary. If you look at anything that I do, any of my work, I always try to encompass a broad range of people and disciplines and ideas. And I incorporate all of that into my thinking, into the ways I'm researching and all those kinds of things. So I just kind of highlight just some of the areas that I, and peoples and disciplines that I work with a lot in order to do my work. And as you read these books and articles that I've written, you can see how I engage and incorporate all of these things, these different disciplines. One of the things that really influenced a lot of my work is what I call a production of silences. You know, Michael Roth Trullo's work, he's an anthropologist. And he really influenced how, when I get into some of the work I'm doing, how I decided to parse open this notion of power, how to tell a story, how a story becomes silenced. And you really are, when you think about how things are silenced, we say silence, but we don't know exactly, we don't really parse down what is it that's being silenced, how is it being done? So not only do I talk about silences, I wanna know where the silences occurred and so that we cannot reproduce it, so we can avoid reproducing it, and also expose the areas and places where we have to really exercise particular due diligence in order to get at those stories. So in order to understand that, we need to think about how they're put together in the first place. And so he starts from the fact that even what is considered a source. And then when we go into archives, as you know, so all these things, you go in the archives, some things are in the archives, a lot of things aren't in the archives, and some things are in the archives in certain ways, in places, and you have to know where to look and what to look for. And, you know, and ask the right questions. And so those are the kinds of things that I get at. And then whose narratives do you decide to pull out of the archives or out of the sources you find? So those are all the things that I'm doing. And then how do I decide to put the story together in the present? And so these are really the underlying ways that I think about some of the projects we're going to talk about.
And sorry, I'm going to talk about- to interrupt, Antoinette, we can't see you changing the slides. We're only seeing one PowerPoint.
Oh, really?
Maybe you could stop sharing the screen, then start sharing it again. Okay. And see if we can see the slides. Sorry to interrupt.
Oh, no problem. I want you to see the slides, that's for sure. So you see a different one now, right?
Yes, we can see it now, thanks.
Okay, let me see if you can see when I change it though. That's the issue. Can you see a different one?
Yes, yes.
Okay, all right, so moving, I'll go quickly back maybe to the, so I was talking about Michael Roth Trullo's work, how is power shared and exercised, and I use that as many of the basis for much of the work I'm doing. But the things that I'm also using are these types of theoretical frames, and I'm not gonna dwell on those, I just want you to see the type of theoretical frames that I'm bringing into play. Primarily the one Sarah was talking about is my most recent kind of frame is this notion of active exclusion. What people actually did to exclude or make sure that entire groups of people were not feeling comfortable, not welcomed, not recognized, and really generally kept away from a place. So that was done on purpose. And those are the kinds of things I really want to expose and have us to understand that in order not to reproduce it, like I said, but also to show really how power is exercised, really how it's done. I start with one of the first communities that I did work in. First, I list three of these communities. It's Sulphur Springs, is right here in Florida. Free Gut is a community in St. Croix Island, the US Virgin Islands. And then Nicodemus, Kansas. I'm not really gonna spend a lot of time on any one of these three, but these three communities are examples of how I really took some of that, those notions that I shared in terms of the theoretical frames and the looking at power and applied it in these community contexts. And also these communities help inform how I came into some of those theoretical frames like active exclusion and things like that. So Sulphur Springs, is right here in Tampa. And the other thing is I shift my purpose when I talk about taking the museum out of the museum space, a fixed space, and out into the community. I'm trying to look not at the monumental, not at the structural, at that structural level, but looking at the lives of everyday people and how they manage and tell their own stories. And one of the things at Sulphur Springs right here in Florida that I noticed was that this community is next to the campus. And what we know about this community is that it was a resort at one point in the 20s, 30s, early part of the 1900s. It was known for as a resort community. And people would come to go to the Sulphur Springs and go to the amusement parks and do all these kinds of things. The first indoor mall was there. But they hear of Sulphur Springs from that perspective, the leisure perspective, but that was a white leisure community. The people who worked there, the people who could not experience those things, lived in this community called Spring Hill. It was just adjacent neighborhood to Sulphur Springs. And we never hear the story of that community. And that was one of the charters, one of my first projects in Tampa, was to work with that community of Spring Hill, which is now considered a really bad or negative connotation of Spring Hill. It's under economic duress. The schools are in challenging positions because of a lack of funding and things like that. But so the community has a negative connotation. But if you dig deep and talk to people who were long-term residents of the community, you learn about this other history, the history of how Sulphur Springs, the Sulphur Springs that was a leisured area, the Sulphur Springs that is, or the place where the golf course and the parks are, were also made in part by these people who lived in Spring Hill, who worked in these places, who catered to these people in those resort communities. And that the identity of those people are not known. And also the people in Sulphur Springs had their own leisured activities, you know, and so their lives, even as workers, as laborers, and their lives as leisured subjects, the people themselves are not known. What were those people in Spring Hill doing? That was an invisible part of the history. And I remember working with my students, some of which are in this slide, because we held a couple of community town halls where we were sharing and gathering information from the community about Spring Hill. They told me, we can't do this work because we looked in the books and there's nothing about Spring Hill. There's nothing, we can't find anything. And I was like, yes, that is the point. We can't find anything and that's where our work is. We are going to help put something in the books, put something in there about this community working with them. And so they thought it was a moment of duress and I thought it was a moment of, you know, it was challenging, but I thought it was a moment that we could actually make a difference and the community could help us with that. So that was, it was always a interesting thing when I think about the duress on the face of my students when they first encountered having to do this project. About in 2017, one of my more recent projects, I work with the National Park Service. And one of the projects here in St. Croix was with the National Park Service, and they were trying to, again, understand African descended communities and their relationship to national park sites and national park projects or things that are dictated by the National Park Service. So one of the things I did was go to St. Croix in this community of Freegut. Was freed Africans created their own community, curated their own community space, had hospitals and schools and churches and all those kinds of things. And now Freegut, like Spring Hill, is considered a not so good area of in St. Croix, in Fredericktown. And so one of the things I did was one summer have workshops in that community, work with students, work with some of the elders in the community to come in and help document the history of that community by, first giving people lessons and workshops on how to collect oral histories and how to store the oral histories and all those and what kind of questions and things to ask and give them a toolkit. And then they went about and did it themselves. But so this is a picture of creating a workshop in which people in the community and students who were living in that community came to understand that and then take that outward. And I remember the workshops. The funny thing about this one is that the workshops were supposed to be one, it was like a series of workshops each day. And each day it was supposed to be another set of people that would come to take the workshop. That's how it was designed. But it ended up being a cumulative. Every day for like 4 days, people would continue to come to the workshop. All the people who came to the workshop the first day came back, plus new people, to the second workshop. And so it became a community event. The elders were so excited that they came, and they were getting interviewed by some of the young people. And it just became almost a celebratory aspect of research that wasn't even built into the project, that people just came every day to participate. And it wasn't a single one day workshop. Like, you know, it was a cumulative thing. And that was interesting. And it spoke to speaks to the point that people, to me, you know, hearing that they get a chance to, knowing that they get a chance to tell their story, they can become active participants in telling it and in shaping it and feeling that, you know, someone and people are really interested in knowing and seeing how it engages, you know, how they can engage with the young people in their community as well. So I think it was another interesting lesson about the curation of a story, a curation of a history right there at the community level with people, and how positive that could be. Nicodemus was another site we went to that's in Kansas, and it was one of the last remaining pioneer towns in which were settled by Black folk who were leaving slavery and setting up their own towns out west. And so the same kind of processes, we went in again, work with the community elders, taught people or how to do podcasts and all those kinds of things, and interviewed them at the sites where they had their former homestead. You can see in that, is the slide changing?
Yes, it is.
Okay. I was like, wait a minute, maybe I'm saying stuff and people don't even see it. But yes, so the elders and people in the community would take us to, you know, the remains of where their homestead might have been and just tell us stories right on the spot. And I remember when I first went to Nicodemus, because again, this is another story. Going to Nicodemus, you have to go to Nicodemus. You don't just happen to be in Nicodemus. You have to make a plan to go to Nicodemus, because it's, you know, 5 hours from Denver, it's 5 hours from Kansas City. So you get on a plane and then you drive into Nicodemus. So you don't happen to find Nicodemus. But when I got into the town, I was driving past and all is just like flat. And all you see just maybe some big oil kind of rigs out there and lots of wheat and things like that. But really, I didn't notice a lot of other things. It was just so flat and the landscape was just a tree here and there and some high, like I said, grain elevators and things like that. But there were things. And when people started telling me stories and they pointed to their pieces, the remains of the homestead, like the bottom left picture, I was like, oh my God, I didn't even notice like these, you know, remains of these kinds of structures buried back in behind a tree or, you know, behind an oil rig or something. I didn't even see it until people started telling the story. And then these things just popped out of the landscape. And some of them were built in dugouts, built right into the hillsides of the landscape. So these are the places and ways that people were living and surviving. And so listening to the elders tell those stories was a quite interesting a perspective. And then seeing how they took control of the telling, Nicodemus really was way more, way more agency in the telling of their story than some of the other communities that I was working with, because Nicodemus really dictated the sites that the Park Service actually owned. They co-owned or owned many of the sites that the Park Service, National Park Service, was using as an interpretive places. They were leased from the community. So the community kept control. They had foresight to keep control of their resources and able to really dictate a lot of the sharing of their story, the key compiling of things, and the ownership was really with the community. So I really learned a lot in terms of agency and actually business knowledge from this community, because they were really, really very proactive in knowing their value, knowing the value of their story, and really insisting on being partners, true partners with the Park Service. So in addition to like those kind of community stories, and all of these are community stories, but I focus also on a lot of curating of cemeteries. And then on face, the curating of a cemetery seems to be maybe a not so exciting thing. But in each case, the curating of the cemetery was not just the curating of the cemetery, but again, it was a curating of the engagement with the living community. That was the story. That was what I was involved in. And the cemetery was a place that held a lot of the stories, a place that the impetus of some of the stories came through working with the physical cemetery. And so in two cases that I'm going to talk about, Dozier, the Boot Hill Cemetery and the St. Mark AME Church Cemetery, you'll see that the way that the curating of cemeteries, again, gets at exposing some of these kinds of narratives, some of these kinds of histories about a community and a people that are often, and have often been ignored and not part of the national story or any story, any local, national, or global story. In the case of Boot Hill, which was a project that I recently worked on with some of my colleagues, I worked with forensic anthropologists, archaeologists, bioarchaeologists, and then a lot of religious practitioners to facilitate this project. And what was going on was Dozier was a school, reform school, in Mariana, Florida, which is in the Panhandle, the flat part of Florida, going toward the west of Tallahassee, and going that way on the Panhandle. And the reform school was a place where, you know, boys, mostly boys, it at one point had boys and girls, were sent when they were, you know, did something wrong or and things like that, and they were supposed to be, you know, educated and also punished in some way, but mostly as a place that they were supposed to be educated and then rehabilitated and let out. But that place was really the Dozier School for Boys really turned into like a work camp, and the education part was only just a word. The education was superficial to the labor that was being extracted from the boys who were sent there. And then people were sent there for really minor reasons. So to get to get sent to Dozier, you could just be truant. You could be, you know, doing something that was very minor and end up there. So many people were there. They didn't even know how they really got there. But there, you know, there were some people who actually had done some pretty bad things. So I interviewed some men who were boys at one point at that Dozier school. And there was many horrible stories about the treatment there. And one of the things that came out was many of those boys, if you ran away or the discipline was very extreme. And so many people ended up dying or being killed, but that was not talked about. And they had a cemetery there where many of those boys who were disappeared were buried. And that was the Boot Hill Cemetery. And my colleague, who's a forensic anthropologist, had family members who were like missing their loved ones, and like they never heard from them again, or got a story that, you know, they were, you know, ran away and they never found them, or just no clear story about what happened to some of their loved ones. So she decided to excavate the cemetery, which was, these markers weren't placed on 101 for a grave. They were more representative of a grave site. And so she actually excavated the grave, and this was like 30 markers, and she found over 55 bodies, actual bodies in that cemetery. And she was able to, you know, connect the bodies to some of the living descendants. And that's when the stories of the abuse and the really horrible things that happened to many of those boys came out. And so not only did the Dozier School provide information, that forensic story about what actually physically happened to the bodies, but it also brought out the history of segregation, racism, and all those kinds of things that were happening in Marianna, Florida, particularly to boys at that cemetery. Because one of the things about segregation at Boot Hill, at Dozier School, that campus was an example of a totally segregated space. It was a north side and the south side of the campus. Everything on the north side was the black side, and the south side was where the white boys were housed. And up until 1964, it was completely segregated. So they had duplicate churches, duplicate dorms, duplicate everything on each campus. And you could go there today and see the two campuses and the separate, you know, the duplicate things on each campus. So it was the first time that you really, really, I really saw like segregation completely in the landscape at that Dozier school. But many of the boys who were buried on this Dozier cemetery were predominantly African-American. And so the story of that, those, the treatment of those boys at that school came out as a result of some of these excavations and this focus on this cemetery. And so it was through the forensics, through the archaeology, and through the interviews that I did with some of the boys who were men who were boys at that time that brought out that story. So the cemetery really represented a way to tell a story that was hidden. And it was one of the darker, this was a dark story for me. The emotional toll of interviewing those boys, those men who were boys on that campus, was even when I did the enslaved Africans, the descendants of that, and hearing those stories, this Boot Hill story and the experiences that some of these men described in terms of the abuse they suffered was really, it was really quite heavy. And it was oftentimes the first time that some of these men told their story of their experience on that campus, not only abuse, but all the other kinds. I mean, mixed in there, you learned a lot of the history of the campus and the community and all those things. But it was really hard to hear some of this telling of the experience that these men had as boys. So this was one of my harder projects, even though the story that came out got really global coverage. It was followed for quite a while by people all over the world, this Dozier School project. But it was really a tough for an anthropologist, a cultural anthropologist, to hear these stories and to embody it, because the town of Marianna, where this school was located, they were mad. They were upset because their town was being painted in a negative light because of the stories coming out of the cemetery. So when I and my students were, you know, going to restaurants or getting coffee or something in the town, we were really, you know, stared at and really sometimes really, it was really kind of a threatening environment. You really didn't want to probably move around by yourself. But people were really anxious, although they did. I did interview people and hear their stories on the other side of things, that there were other reasons why people in the town didn't think they were being represented well. So I actually, you know, did a totality of the story, but it was a rough project. And I used the notion of the uncanny as a theoretical frame in this case. I never used it before, but I wanted to capture, again, how do you reconcile, how do you consolidate the information and the knowledge that you're finding out that is coming out of a space that should probably have never been reopened again. And so I use that notion of uncanny to capture that, to start to think about all the feelings and all the things that emerged as a result of that, because the feelings were so intense. The other cemetery project, which was a little less dark in that sense, was the archery, the Jimmy Carter National Historic Site and the Boyhood Farm. Jimmy Carter lived in this community called Archery, which was predominantly an African-American community during his boyhood. And so he talks a lot about in his books about archery. And so part of the project with the National Park Service was to work with Jimmy Carter and also the community of Archery to find out, you know, the history of the community of Archery, which was not documented. All what people really had in terms of the history of archery was through Jimmy Carter. So part of this was also a power dynamic, a real power dynamic practice for me, how to navigate those power structures. And it was real because Jimmy Carter had his story of the town and Archery and his life. And then there was the people in Archery who had their own understanding and history about the town. And how do I put those stories together and not, you know, and talk to a president. So that was a little much. And I remember one of the things I had to do was interview Jimmy Carter as part of this project to, you know, get his take on things. And the first time that I had put my little question set together to interview him about the Archery and all these things, he was like, I already answered all those things in my book. And so unless you have some other questions, you know, I'm not doing the interview. So I was like, whoa. And so, about 3 months later, 4 months later, I had done some work, a lot of work in the community. And one of the things we did was curate the cemetery of the St. Mark AME Church and create a map of, you know, we walked through, did a lot of walkthroughs with elders in the community to talk, you know, to identify some of the unmarked graves, to get some of the history of the some of the grave and burials out there in that cemetery, and just compile a list and of names and people buried there, and really, you know, make those stories come alive and make that history come alive, and really learn about Archery from that community's perspective, as opposed to what Jimmy Carter saw when he drove through or went there to collect rent or whatever he was doing, but really understand the community. And one of the things I got out of the community was like, we were here long before Jimmy Carter. This was a community that Jimmy Carter, he inherited. We were a community. We didn't get shaped by Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter, we made Jimmy Carter. So, and then they had the county line. They had two sides of Archery. And they said, well, he lived on the other side of the county line. So we don't even count that as him being really technically an Archery. And so they had like all of these different notions of the boundaries of the community and really, really big pride in the fact that, you know, they had a school in that community, they had churches and stores, and they had really an active, really active community. and so the output of the project was to create a series of posters, and we gave talks and things like that about documenting some of the information we found out about the community. And so the second time I tried to get an interview with Jimmy Carter, and I told many of the community people that, hey, I did get on the docket. He said, okay, I can interview. He was agreeing to the second time I tried. And I told the community members, I was like nervous, of course, that I was going to interview him. And they were like they were coaching me about, you know, what to say and what stories or something like that. So it was so funny. And then the Park Service said, you know, when the interview comes, you won't really know. You don't get like 2 weeks and an exact date that you're going to know that you're going to have the interview. It's like they call you up and say, the interview is tomorrow. You're like, what? And so that's the interview itself, because they don't want to telegraph it. And so I got a call, interview was going to happen. And they, you know, the Park Service says, if he doesn't like where this is going, you will only have 5 minutes. And I was like, okay. So I said, oh, well, I have to front load all my questions in the first 5 minutes in case it's a bust. And so I get in there, he comes, and I give him a little story about, you know, something one of the community members had told me about him and doing hogs. They would slaughter hogs, and something about Jimmy Carter's relationship to that they thought was interesting. They wanted me to remind him about that. But he comes in, we start in on interviews. I'm talking real fast. And then he answers all of my questions in the first question. Like, I asked one question, and then he answers everything I had on my paper that I had given him, all in one package response. And so I had to break it down, and I had some backup questions. And it was because we had done all this work in the cemetery that he got really excited about listening to the conversations that came about in doing the cemetery work and all those kinds of things. And that made the interview go for like 50 minutes or so. And it was very interactive. And so it was because I had spent time with the community and understood these things like Sumter County, Webster County, the county line, and all of the notions about all the things about what was going on in the cemetery and life in that community that he didn't experience from that perspective. So he was really interested. And so it became a dialogue. So again, the community curated their own story, and that even informed the, you know, informed the president's understanding of a community in a way he hadn't understood. So that was, you know, that was one of the ultimate things about really working in community in ways in which a story that hadn't been told had an impact, not only in the telling of the Park Service's narrative, but in the actual telling of a person who was like central to that community. So that was a very positive experience. And so in summary, some of the living, engaging with these living communities, I actually go into meeting people where they are, going to the places and things that are important to them. That's the really the critical thing in terms of learning about these stories that are not typically heard of. And then working with the local, national, cross-cultural dialogue. How do you infuse what I find into a national, global, or cross-cultural perspective to engage other people in the discussion? And then taking a critical approach, knowing that these stories were left out and why, and all the ways that I talked about in the beginning, that knowing how these processes work, how do I actually, you know, circumvent that to put in, to make sure I get to engage with the knowledge that has been subjugated. Okay, so those are, and then also train, mentor, and incorporate students is a key part of the work that I do. And working with community stakeholders, I don't wanna just take the research and do it and leave. I want the people there to have the tools, the toolkit, the confidence and things like that to really keep it going, because I know I can't stay in these places forever, and that the history and the ways of doing this is important at the community level more than it is something for me to come back over and over again. I mean, I may come back regularly, but really the key thing is to leave the tools and things with the community so that they can continue on and have some access to the same things I did. And then these are some of the outputs of some of the deliverables for various Park Service projects that came about. And many of these things are on, I have a Heritage Research Lab website. So you can see many of these projects I talked about out there at that website. And then in conclusion, I really want to talk quickly about my current project. The University of South Florida just issued a series of grants to get at, you know, with Black Lives Matter protests and movement, and also the protests on Floyd's killing and all those things that have been in the media. The University of South Florida has issued a $500,000 worth of grants out there to internal grants to faculty to go and do research on communities of African descent and really highlight some of these hidden and untold stories in these communities and really put the university in conversation in a real way, in a financially invested way, and making sure that this history and these histories and these representations are taken seriously. And my project is called the African American Burial Grounds and Remembering Project. And I'm looking at two cemeteries in the state of Florida in which the city in Zion, two cemeteries, I'm looking at Zion Cemetery in Tampa, in which a housing complex has been built in the 1950s, were built right over top of graves, and an entire housing complex. And now through archaeological work, GPR work, ground penetrating radar discoveries and things like that, they found that those bodies and graves in that cemetery is still there. For whatever reason, the records got lost. People didn't know that the cemetery apparently was there. And the city went about using the land for other things. But, you know, that is controversial, not really controversial, because they really actually knew it was a cemetery there. They didn't care that it was there. And they built this housing complex. The first housing complex at Zion was a white only community, in which they were encouraging people to move to Florida, the sunshine state, you know, set up residency and come and live in Florida. So they built this beautiful housing complex and over top of the cemetery. And even when they were doing that, they found the people digging up the land to build the buildings, found a couple caskets that made the news in 1950, 51 or something, that they found some graves, and they were like, oh, those were just remains. We really moved them all somewhere else. So that's just an anomaly that those few ones are still there. So they kept on with the building, built the whole complex. Today, that complex, Robles Park, is a complex for people with poor economic means, and so it's a not so good reputation for that complex. But these people are living in public housing on top of the grave, and now that it's been discovered for that in the news, and people have really started excavating that site, what do you do about these histories, these graves, these people? And the city, who decided that they were in care and build over top of a cemetery. So now what do you do? And so my project is to go and look at what the living communities are wanting to do about the things they face, the relocation. Many of them are being relocated to other places. And then what does the city do about memorializing that? What does the city do economically about, doing something about that area that they, you know, abandon over all these years in order to build this complex? So it's lots of questions about what can be done in the present. And then also, how do you document the history of Tampa in the city and the people responsible for, you know, ignoring this history and abandoning this cemetery at all this time? And the same thing with a cemetery called Oaklawn in St. Petersburg, which is right across the bay. As you know, the Rays, I don't know if you pay attention to the sports in the U.S., then the World Series is happening. And the Tampa Bay Rays, who play at Tropicana Field, the baseball stadium, that stadium too is built over, the parking lot is built over a historically African-American cemetery. And they're just now starting to find out that, yes, this is there, because they want to redevelop Tropicana Field. They want to put something else or make a bigger stadium or do something else with that property. And now they're starting to, you know, excavate and survey the land. And now they've come to find that all these graves are supposedly moved. They weren't. And they had built this stadium right over top of a historically African-American community, for one thing, and then particularly over top of some cemeteries. So again, this project that I'm working on now is to talk to people who may have been buried in that cemetery, or who were part of these communities that have been forgotten, ignored, built over, and bring those communities back into conversation. Well, what do we do in the present with these sites and these land areas that, you know, the redevelopment? What do we do now? And how do you involve these communities and these histories in how we go forward? So again, all of the same things I've been doing, but it's very, very current. These stories, very, very current in terms of what do we do with these histories. And just yesterday, I rode by the Zion Cemetery, that's over where the Robles Park housing complex is. You can see in the background that the boarded up buildings, those are the ones that are gonna be torn down and more excavation done, because burials are underneath all those buildings. And on the fence that's surrounding, they put a big construction fence up. They put banners now that are hanging on these fences that the Public Archaeology Network at Florida Public FPAN, Florida Public Archaeology Network, has created a little bit of a memorial. This is just temporary, in which they kind of document some of the history of the cemetery. They have names, if you can see that the slide on the left side. There are names of people who were buried in that cemetery, a whole, just their names, all the names just listed out that they know to date. So it's a whole like memorial banners all around the fence area. And many times people in the community come up. When I was there yesterday, I asked a guy about where this was, and he was like, oh yeah, it's right over there. And people are pretty actively engaged in knowing, you know, in kind of welcoming this attention to this, to this cemetery site that is now the housing complex. So, so how do you deal with this? And this is what is going to be my project, is how do you make these stories present, and how do you interface and engage in the current conversation of what next? And so I call this current phase of work really curating racism. Like, how do you actually get in there and talk about these things with concrete projects, concrete experiences, whose story, what history, where do we start? And that's where I am right now with this project. You know, where do we start and how do we really dig in there? And it concludes with my book that Sarah was talking about, is Heritage, Tourism, and Race, The Other Side of Leisure. It's my most recent book, and it's talking about active exclusion as a key theory in there. How were sites of leisure and how were people during segregation in the US when Black folk weren't allowed to go to certain national parks or any national park really without many stipulations on whether how they can enter, where they can stay, how they can move about. And then thinking about the Native American communities and how they were totally excluded from their own lands at many of these national parks. So this book looks at leisure, the places we visit, sites we visit on a regular basis, particularly national parks, and what stories, what information you don't hear when you go to these parks, or that don't come into the forefront when the park is interpreting the history of their park. And I say that these parks have to embrace and have to interpret these stories, this history directly, you know, or else we continue to perpetuate. So, you know, even though the park is no longer excluding Black people, no longer doing some of the things that, you know, that are negative in there from that perspective, that history is still intertwined into what made that site in the first place and how people come to know about that park and what they know about that park. And if you don't include the histories of people that you totally excluded through racism just because of race, then what you are having presenting an incomplete history. And so that is the gist of my book. And one of the things, the front cover of the book is Lincoln Beach. And that's in New Orleans where I grew up, where I was born and my parents grew up. And it was a historically segregated beach. And that was the Black beach. Lincoln Beach was the Black beach in New Orleans, really one of the few places that Black folk could go prior to 1964. And I remember asking my mother about Lincoln Beach, and I had really never paid attention to that history until I just got interested in being an anthropologist and doing all this research. And she is telling me, yeah, I know Lincoln Beach, because I was just doing research. And she said, yeah, I know Lincoln Beach. I used to, and she gave me all these stories about being at Lincoln Beach. And so the book not only paints of the story of exclusion and what exactly was done to exclude Black folk from many of these sites, but it also talks about what people were doing in terms of leisure. And I think that's a big contribution. We often hear about, you know, what was bad or what was negative or what was done to marginalize people, but we don't talk a lot about what the agency that folk brought to their own situation, to their own humanity. Black folk were leisuring. They were going to amusement parks. They were going to the beach. They had hotels and places they were visiting and frequenting. And those things we don't talk about that, you know? So it's always some kind of shock when, oh yeah, Black folks were skiing. They had, or Black folks were playing tennis or doing, they were doing it in places that people really didn't care about. They didn't care about Black communities or spaces in which these things were happening because they couldn't do them in the mainstream because they were excluded, but that didn't mean that they weren't doing it. And so that's what my book brings out as well. What were people doing when they were excluded? Active exclusion was going on and active agency was also going on. And so I think we need to tell and make sure we keep that perspective or else we get this paternalistic discussion about those poor people were, you know, couldn't do this, and so they don't, they're lacking in some way. No, the system was lacking. Folk were doing what they were doing, and we need to bring that all together and make sure that we don't repeat these kinds of things. So that's what I try to do in this book. And that's really the primary aim, is to really show the agency and the structural racism side by side so that we have a better conversation going forward. So that's the end of my talk. I have zillions of more things that I could tell and stories to tell. But right now, I'll just wait and see if you guys have any questions. And I thank you for giving me the time.
Thank you so much. One of the really